Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Well, hi again, everyone. I'm 1010 Wins Sports Director Mark Renee. This is On the Mark, where we check into the stories behind the stories in the world of sports. And today we are in the book nook with author Glenn Lewis to talk sparring with Smokin' Joe. Joe Frazier's epic battles and rivalry with Muhammad Ali. The book comes out today, February 10th, 2021, just ahead of next month's, hard to believe, 50th anniversary of the fight of the century at Madison Square Garden. That was March 8th of 71, the first of what would be three epic battles between Frazier and Ali. Glenn Lewis is joining us on Zoom. Glenn, thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no, I'm so glad to be here. I always admire the work on 1010 Wins. Great stuff.
And how are you? How have you been handling things over the course of the last 11 months?
Pretty amazing. It's been sort of a whirlwind of you know, interviews and things to, you know, to concentrate on to market the book, especially in this kind of environment, you know, where you're dealing with the pandemic and, you know, a lot of things keep changing. The other thing also is not only writing the book, but now having to talk a lot about it after doing the book. This is a strange situation for me because I did the reporting for this book 40 years ago. The reporting for this book was done in 1980. And of course, you know, more research lately in writing up the book. But the bulk of the stories come from our time together in 1980. And it's very strange going back and looking at yourself as part of the story at that time and first getting adjusted to who you were 40 years ago. You know, not an everyday occurrence. So I feel like I'm reliving parts of my life that were long past as if they're new again.
Yeah, now I don't want to give away the really good parts of the book, but you literally take us inside the lair, Joe's lair at his boxing gym in Philadelphia. And I was wondering, obviously, any interviews that you would have done most recently with Joe would have had to be more than 10 years ago, because that's how long, sadly, he's been gone now. And I'm wondering, because you brought it up, you started this project 40 some odd years ago. What took so long to get the book finally out?
That's a good question. I think part of it was trying to be sensitive to the family. Originally, the history of this book is very strange. I originally was on assignment from Esquire to spend time and cover. Basically, they were looking for a story of Joe's comeback and Ali's comeback, because Ali had already announced that he was coming out of retirement to fight Larry Holmes for the championship. And the rumor was that Joe was going to follow suit. And everybody started envisioning an Ali Frazier 4 and how that would have been the mother of all fights. And so that perked my curiosity or piqued my curiosity. And I got, you know, the people at Esquire interested as well. So the article went well, everything went well. It just so happened that the person who had been the editor for the article left just before the article was supposed to be published. And they had a policy where they didn't publish articles where the editor wasn't there. So it was very strange. The article was accepted and paid for, and then they said, you can do what you want with it. And so Sports Illustrated was interested at one point, and Inside Sport, a few other places. Then I decided to hold on to it because my agent at the time thought it might make a good documentary or a good movie, made for TV movie. So I held on to it for a while. I wanted to do something with it in the mid to late 90s, but Joe came out with his own autobiography at that time. And I didn't want to feel like, you know, that he thought I was competing with him. And then later on, when Joe died in 2011, I didn't want to make it look like I was cashing in on, right, on the family's misfortune. And then one more time, Marvis self-published a book with another person in 2013. And again, I just didn't want them to feel like I was going to be an impediment for them. And after that, I sort of put it away for a while. And then when I noticed that, you know, the Fight of the Century's 50th anniversary would be coming up in a couple of years, I sort of thought to myself, I got to write this story. It's got something I got to write before it's too late. And when I looked over the original notes and transcript, everything became so vivid. And I realized how good the stories were that I really wanted to buckle down and write the book.
Yeah, so what was it like to go back in time and relive all those moments?
Very, very strange. You know what's really funny? You have a concept of yourself as a reporter or doing your job at different times of your life. And when I started to look back at myself, literally 40 years later, very early in my career, the first thing that struck me is how many mistakes I was making in the reporting, you know, while I was doing it. So I was sort of, you know, reading the notes and cringing at my reporting mistakes, which I point out a lot of them in the book. You know, why in the world did I do this? Or why in the world did I do that? The other thing you sort of know, and you would know this, Mark, so often when you're doing these kinds of interviews and reporting, that there's sort of like one jerk in the room, you know, one guy who sort of doesn't get what's supposed to be going on.
Right.
And the thing that made me cringe is I was the jerk in the room. I started to realize that, you know, in the first couple of times, you know, in the first chapter of the book, my interview with Joe turns into like a tug of war at the end. And I'm really pushing him hard to get him to admit that he's going to come out of retirement to fight, you know, to try and fight for a championship. And because, you know, that seemed to be the crux of the story. But I treated it like I had 10 minutes to get the answer and really pressed much too hard. And it wasn't until sort of now, looking back, realizing that I needed to chill out a little bit. I created tension between me and Joe that could have blown the whole thing up. Luckily for me, Joe was a very resilient, kind-hearted, a good guy who, even when he felt offended, would be cool enough to think about it and blow it off and go back to what he had to do. And that's, if you think about it, that's something he had to learn to do over the years because of his treatment by the press, his treatment by the public after certain things with Ali. So he became sort of zen about dealing with people.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about the rivalry between those two. I also want to talk to you about his post-fight career, because you went to a bunch of his musical gigs over the course of that phase of his career. And I think a lot of us still remember the beer commercials that he did, Smokin' Joe and the Knockouts.
Right.
And you know, we're nostalgic for that. But I have to start with this, if you don't mind, because obviously the bulk of the tales of that rivalry, the Ali-Frazier rivalry, are told from Muhammad Ali's perspective.
Oh, totally. So he created the dialogue.
Right. So I'm compelled to ask, Glenn, what drew you to Joe as opposed to Muhammad?
That's really a good question. I always had the perception that Ali was much more open to the press. It was much easier to get into his inner circle. Years ago, I was friends with Mark Cram Sr., who had a reputation for following Ali around and and writing Sports Illustrated stories. And I think he did a book with him as well. So he used to tell me about how competitive it was for Ollie's time. The other thing that struck me is it seemed to me that even then, the whole narrative about their relationship filtered through Ollie. You know, all the stories that were written about them were written through Ollie's perspective. And obviously in public, when they would, you know, be promoting a fight or taking sides, you know, in what seemed like a sort of chippy, you know, approach to, you know, promoting the fight, it was always Ollie that was setting the tone for the conversation and sort of assigning who they were. And I just really wanted to hear the other point of view. I thought if I could get Joe to talk to me, then I would get a more complete sense of who he is. That's the other thing too. Everybody felt they knew Ollie. They knew who he was. They felt almost like he was a friend because his character and his demeanor were so larger than life that he sort of popped through for everybody. A lot of people really didn't have a sense of who Joe was at all. You know, they had the Joe that they saw through Ollie's views. They had the Joe that Ollie allowed him to be on a limited basis as he was dominating the dialogue. And one of the things I wanted to do was to let people see Joe's humanity and who he really was and how he really perceived things, because I had the feeling then we really weren't getting his thoughts. We were getting Ollie's projection of him. And the other thing also, I think people assumed that Joe wasn't that bright because he didn't get to really carry his share of the dialogue. But some of that is just, if you try too hard against somebody who's a big personality, it makes you look needy. And that really wasn't true with Joe. Joe was a very strong-willed, very self-confident, very perceptive kind of guy who learned much of what he learned through life experience. You know, you got to remember, Ollie grew up in a middle-class family in Louisville, more in the city. Joe grew up working with his father as a sharecropper on really tough rural farms. And he grew up in the Jim Crow South. And he put up with a lot of scary, tough situations and handled them really well. So his life experience ability was much more than what people realized.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, there's a lot of focus in the book on Georgia and the Augusta area and the things that went on there. But so many of us associate Joe Frazier with Philadelphia. True. So how did he wind up establishing his roots in Philly?
Good. What he did is he was like 16 years old or 15 and a half, 16 years old when he had to leave the South. On his mother's own advice. And he headed north originally to Harlem to live with a relative there and to his first time in a major city. And then from Harlem, he eventually headed towards Philadelphia because he heard there were jobs available there. And he really, at that point, wasn't set on boxing. Boxing was more like something he wanted to try, honestly, because he was overweight and was trying to get into some sort of shape. And he always was a fighter as a kid, you know, more like a street fighter.
Right.
And so at one point, he must have been about 30 pounds overweight. And he found a police athletic league gym in Philadelphia to go to work out. And luckily, at some point, Yank Durham, who wound up becoming his father figure, late in the years, father figure and manager and trainer, saw him fighting, saw the potential, and sort of began to work with him and build him into, you know, a fighter. The big thing he noticed was the power of his left hook and his ability to move well despite his weight. And the big thing that Yank did was build up his durability and turned him into someone who trained way above anybody he had to fight. That was always Yank's position, is that Joe should be in much better shape and train much harder than anyone he has to go up against. And as a result, he was always stronger in the late rounds.
And that peekaboo style of his too, where he came in with his arms up over his head, covering his face, it's burned into my memory banks, and just his raw power was so frightening. We're with Glenn Lewis, author of Sparring with Smokin' Joe, Joe Frazier's Epic Battles and Rivalry with Muhammad Ali. Now, before we get into the fights, I had asked you this before we started recording. I wanted to revisit because over the years, I think I have been able to come to appreciate this rivalry between the two of them, a rivalry that a lot of people think might be the premier rivalry individually in all of sports. And I want to ask you a little bit about that as we move ahead. But I thought of, you know, this animosity, this good guy versus bad guy, this Ali as the people's champion, especially the black people's champion, versus Frazier. And I'm wondering, Glenn, how much of the animosity was really a result of a miscommunication or a series of miscommunications? Because I think back to the footage we see on YouTube now and other places of those initial press conferences leading up to the fight of the century at the Garden in 71, and Muhammad Ali beating up on the toy gorilla and calling Joe, you know, among other things, a gorilla, and portraying him as not such a smart guy, as Siri interrupts. She wants to answer the question for me. but I've always wondered, you know, looking back now, how much of it was supposed to be just a show that Ali was putting on, and maybe Joe didn't get the joke?
Yeah, good point. Here's the problem with that. I think a lot of it started that way. Ali wanted to create this vision of the good black man, the inferior black man, and that was one of the ways to sort of create this divide and this, you know, this animosity. He wanted Joe to react to a certain degree, so this there was this appearance of a real dislike that supposedly would make for a better fight, and he thought that his, you know, witty comments and everything is going to build the audience. The problem was Joe started to not get it and not really enjoy it as much when it reached a point where the fight had sold out all over the world. It was already the biggest fight in individual purse for both fighters, $2.5 million, you know, guaranteed for both of them. It was already the biggest fight in as far as viewership. This was one of the first truly mega fights that were advertised and viewed worldwide through closed circuit television and theaters and places like that. There was already going to be close to 1 billion people watching the fight, and Ali was still doing the same act, and he was still continuing to denigrate Joe. And the thing that really surprised Joe is the level of the things Ali was now saying kept getting worse and worse and more cutting, you know, and it got to the point where he was calling Joe an Uncle Tom, you know. And there's a line in the book from one of the interviews that broke my heart, because you could see that Joe wanted very much to like Ali. They were friends to begin with. They enjoyed their time together. You know, they're not so dissimilar in sense of humor and things like that. But Joe was so hurt by the idea of being called an Uncle Tom, right, which was the opposite of what he was, that at one point he sort of said, yeah, the only time I tommed myself out, the only time I was an Uncle Tom was for Ali.
Right.
When I came on to make excuses for him, when I came on to sort of beg the public to, you know, excuse and accept what he had done. He said, so the thing that's so crazy from his perspective, he's being called an Uncle Tom by Ali. And in his mind, the only time he ever acted in any shape or form like a Tom was to help Ali.
That is very interesting. So 1971, it's March 8th. This is a fight that you talked about, you know, with the closed circuit. The Garden is sold out. There are a billion people that are going to be watching this fight as it happens in some form or other. If memory serves, Frank Sinatra was credentialed as a photographer for Life magazine.
And did the cover. He did the cover photo.
Right, did the cover photo. Burt Lancaster, the actor, was a color commentator on one of the broadcasts. Glenn, what do you remember about that night?
Oh, man. Well, here's one of the things that was sort of my dark secret when I first came in to cover Joe. I was like, you know, sort of a college age kind of guy at that point, I guess. And like most of my friends, like most of the country, I was crazy for Ali. I mean, I was rooting heavily for Ali. I was desperate for him to kick the hell out of Joe, you know, and take back his title. I was totally bought into Ali and really not all that aware of Joe at that fight. You know, I know I had seen and covered, you know, a couple of his more recent fights, and I knew how good he was, but I wanted Ali to win just like everyone else. And I remember also how this was not a casual thing. People weren't rooting casually for one or the other. The closest thing I could think of is the divide that Donald Trump created in recent months and years. You were either an Ali person or you were a Frazier person. You either saw the world like Ali or you saw the world like people thought Joe saw it. Again, who knew for sure at that point, because it was all, you know, manufactured by Ali. And people were clearly in two camps. Frank Sinatra and all those guys were crazy for Joe. They were there, they cared so much because they wanted Joe to win. Other groups were crazy for Ali. The other thing also is you had to remember that these weren't just boxing fans. Ali had created a phenomenon in boxing where more than half the people who are now following his fights and following boxing were not boxing fans, they were Ali fans.
Right.
And that was not quite the same thing. So they started off with a lack of appreciation for Joe because they really didn't know boxing. All they knew was Ali. And part of that was the showmanship and you know, the personality and the rhymes and the predictions and all that. So the hype around it was amazing. The politics, the racial politics around the fight were enormous. The political points of view were incredible. You got to remember, a lot of the people following this fight were either for the Vietnam War or against the Vietnam War in a very strong manner. Right. And some of the people saw themselves as vehemently supporting civil rights and others maybe not so much. And all of that got mixed into the atmosphere of the fight.
So there wasn't even a lot of specifically Joe Frazier backers. It was more anti-Ali.
Yeah, I would say that happened to a certain degree for sure. And I saw remnants of that down in the South years later when I was traveling with Joe. Some of the white people that we spoke to, more affluent white people, would begin not so much talking. I mean, they loved Joe down there because he was also local, but they would begin talking more about how Ali's politics turned them off. And you got to remember, he was a member of the Nation of Islam, and they were seen as putting out a lot of anti-white rhetoric at that time. I don't think Ali was as bought into that as the people in general. Ali, just like Joe, did very well in relating to people of all backgrounds. I think that was part of their character and part of their appeal. But people saw him as representative of the Nation of Islam. And in some people's eyes, that was a huge plus. And in other people's eyes, it was something they saw as ominous.
Okay, so this was the first of what would be three fights in the Ali Frazier rivalry. And I know that you are a proponent of the fact or the position that this rivalry in particular is the greatest individual rivalry in the history of sports. And I have been racking my brain trying to come up with something that might knock it off that perch. And the best I could come up with in terms of individual sports, because obviously you have Yankees, Red Sox, Lakers, Celtics, Duke, Carolina, the Bears and the Packers in the team sports categories. I came up with Borg and McEnroe.
That's definitely
that was
one
a really long time ago. And currently, the best I could come up with was Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal. But the problem is, most tennis fans love both guys. So there's not really, there's a rivalry in terms of, you know, how many times they played each other and on a big stage. But there's really no battle lines drawn, because those who like Federer don't necessarily hate Nadal, and those who like Rafa don't necessarily hate Roger. So is there anything even close to the rivalry of Ali and Frazier?
That's a good question. A few years ago, quite a few of the major sports outlets, both the established ones like New York Times and LA Times and places like that, and also some of the more edgy ones like the different, you know, websites that rate these things as well, were literally doing just that. They were looking to rate the greatest individual rivalries of all time. And more than half of them put Ali Frazier at the top as the best rivalry, you know, individually. There was about four or five rivalries that appeared on just about every list. So one of them was Larry Bird and Magic Johnson, obviously in basketball. Another one was Nicklaus and
Palmer.
And Palmer, thank you. Nicklaus and Palmer in golf. The Borg McEnroe one certainly came up. And then Ali and Frazier came up. You know, there were, you know, I could think of others myself. If you go back further, and you might be too young for this, but Will Chamberlain and Bill Russell would be one that would, you know, for basketball people, that would always, you know, loom larger. But, you know, with my way of looking at it, those are team sports.
Right.
Where there's two guys that had some impact, but not the same. The other thing also, I think when you're talking about a rivalry, and a rivalry that's going to be the greatest of all time, there's got to be more at stake than just winning and losing games. There's got to be your personality, your position in the world, and how people perceive you. It seemed to me that every time Ali and Frazier hooked up, they were being judged as people. They were being judged for their positions. They were being judged in how they handled the hype. It was so much more than just handling the fight. And then again, when it's a boxing match, and somebody could come out really injured and really, you know, beaten up badly, there's so much more that you're risking than just a game.
Right.
And then as we saw in the fight of the, not the fight of the century, but as we saw in the Thriller in Manila, the third fight, at the end of the fight, Ali won simply because Joe's camp quit 10 seconds before Ali's camp would have quit, you know, before coming out for the last round. And when they asked Ali about his great victory, he said, "Are you kidding? That was the closest thing to dying I ever thought of, I ever imagined."
Yeah, so, and that fight really did take a toll on both of them that lasted far beyond October of 1975. By the way, before we move on, I don't want to get any angry emails or phone calls. Listen, I'm as big a tennis guy as there is. I did not forget Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova's rivalry. And in fact, while we're talking here, I looked it up. They met 80 times over the course of their career, and 60 of those matches were in finals of tournaments.
That's amazing.
And that one might be close for the political ramifications and the social ramifications. So the other tennis rivalries that I mentioned didn't really have the social and political angles to them quite so much as Chrissy and Martina did. And of course, you know, over the course of time, we have, as a society, especially in America, with the fall of communism and everything, and our evolution sociologically, we have come to embrace Martina much more than we did back then. So, you know, that's, I think, true. If we back on that rivalry, that it might, pardon the bad pun here, might rival Ali Frazier. But obviously, you know, for the general public, I think Ali Frazier ranks far beyond. So we did not mean to gloss over the second fight, which was also at the Garden. That was in January of 74. And I have to tell you, Glenn, you gave me a terrific idea. I haven't had time to do it yet, but you went back and rewatched that second fight, which Ali was given the decision in. And I'm curious to know, before I go back and watch it myself with a pad and paper and keep score myself, how legit do you think the scoring of that fight was?
You know, it wasn't one of these things where one or the other won by a huge margin. But on the other hand, Joe was very rarely adamant about something. And I remember we were in one of the nightclubs in Augusta, mostly a nightclub for richer African-Americans and mostly a white clientele, wealthy white clientele. And people were asking Joe questions about his career and all that. And, you know, one of them sort of said, in my opinion, you won all three fights. And Joe sort of admitted, not all three. I quit before Ali did in the final fight. So I obviously didn't win that. But he did say, when it comes to the second fight, I was robbed. And at the time, I sort of glossed over it in my reporting because I had always thought that the fight was closer and that Joe had done better than they indicated, but I wasn't sure if he was robbed or not. I didn't remember scoring the fight that closely when I was watching it originally. So before writing the book, I noticed that I found original articles from Red Smith and from Anderson in the New York Times, you know, both of them Pulitzer Prize, you know, winners of sports columnists, you know, Dave Anderson. And both of them had felt that Joe had won the fight. You know, they had it scored pretty closely, but they both felt that Ali had gotten too much credit for just tap, tap, tapping and running away.
Right.
And when he wasn't running away, he was holding and holding and holding. As a matter of fact, Joe's manager at the time counted 130 holds during the fight by Ali, which is insane. You're talking about, you know, a 12-round fight. So you're talking about then more than 10 holdings by Joe, 10 times, by Ali, for each round. Think about how much time that takes off the clock as well. So basically every time he saw Joe getting off, every time he felt like he was going to lose an exchange, he smothered him. And so there's something that has to be said for taking the initiative in a fight. There's something that has to be said for being the aggressor. There's something that has to be said for being willing to fight to begin with. And there shouldn't have been penalties for so much holding. I mean, that's like ridiculous. And the other thing also that got discussed by Dave Anderson and Smith, and that I saw in the fight, you know, as well, is that this thing was supposed to be scored like a pro fight, and pro fights are scored by the punches you land that do damage and how much damage they do. Where in the amateurs, it's just counting contact. So a lot of guys in the amateurs will come in and do a little explosion of light taps and then run away, and they scored a lot of points, and you can win the fight that way. But you're not supposed to be able to win a heavyweight championship that way. And that's pretty much what Ali's strategy was. Go in, tap, 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 run away, hold, win the round, and go on and try to do the next thing in the next round. And it just was not legitimate for a heavyweight championship bout.
Well, the question
actually, it wasn't a championship bout. Actually, the second fight was the only fight where they really weren't fighting for a championship.
Right.
It should impact their legacy.
Well, that's the thing. If the scoreboard read Frazier 2, Ali nothing, what are the chances that we still have what came to be known as the Thrilla in Manila?
Good question. If put yourself in the position of Joe's manager, if Joe had won the first two fights against Ali, somebody that literally the whole country, the whole world was urging on to and hoping he would win, you know, but here he beats him twice. Why would he risk a third match if he's already got the better of Ali?
Right.
And why would he go on and have easier paydays elsewhere? You know, why risk it? The whole thing about the Thriller in Manila, it's supposed to be the rubber match. You know, Joe won the first, Ali won the second. Let's have a rubber match and see who's really the best. What would be the hype for a rubber match if somebody had lost two already?
Right.
And then you got to say to yourself, what would that do to their standings? I don't think it would elevate Joe as a contender for the greatest, you know, of all time. On the other hand, it might have made people rethink whether Ali would now be considered the greatest of all time. You know, you got to remember Ali's fight against Foreman came because of this win in the second fight. And so there might not have been a rumble in the jungle either.
And the entire course of boxing history would have been changed.
Yeah, I mean, I personally think that Ali would have still had a good chance to hold on to the title of the greatest. But just as realistically, he could have been battling Joe Louis and Foreman and maybe Marciano, although I don't think he was big enough to really fight against these guys. He could have been in competition with those guys for who would be dubbed the greatest. I mean, you could even make a case, you know, years later for Holmes as well.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you about Larry Holmes because he does play a part in this story. Another Pennsylvania guy, Larry, of course, the Easton assassin. I thought it was interesting because I got the impression that Larry and Joe were fairly close. Larry got in the ring with Marvis Frazier fairly early in Marvis's career and picked him apart inside early. Way too early, but he picked him apart way too early. That was not quite as bad as what Mike Tyson did to Marvis, but it was fairly similar, right?
Right. But, you know, here's one of the things people forget. Marvis fought for the heavyweight championship, although technically he didn't because it wasn't a sanctioned fight. But he got to fight the heavyweight champion who was in his prime, who was undefeated at 44-0 or something like that at the time, who had won several, had defended his championship several times against top fighters and was literally knocking everybody out. I think people forget just how big Holmes was at that time. Even if he only weighed, you know, 215 or 220, he was a massive guy.
Yeah.
With an incredibly long reach and with a lot of experience. And he was very close friends with Joe, and he knew Marvis his whole life. I think Marvis and Holmes are very close today. And he never wanted to hurt him. He never wanted to be in the ring with him. And he sort of warned Joe about that at one point. And because he, as he pointed out to Joe, once you're in the ring, you got to defend yourself. You know, and all you could think of is winning. Otherwise, you're making yourself too vulnerable. And I think it hurt him to literally beat up Marvis that way. And yeah. I don't know if the same thing would have been the result if Marvis had, or if Joe had held Marvis off like 10 or 12 more fights to get him the experience you really need to be in the ring with a guy that size. After 10 pro fights, you're just not ready. One of the things I do in the book is I count up not only the amount of fights each guy had had as a pro, but who they had fought, and also how many fights the people they fought had fought cumulatively, how much experience they brought with them. And the difference was amazing. It's something like the people Marvis fought had a total of maybe 50 rounds of pro fighting, you know, on their resume, and there was only 10 of them. When you look at Holmes, he had fought, you know, 40 some odd fights where his opponents had hundreds, like 300 or 400 right. rounds of fighting experience. So sort of really in the not in the same world.
Hey, Glenn, I mentioned how the course of boxing history might have changed if Joe had won that second fight at the Garden in 74. But you also got me thinking when you talked about Joe, when he first left the South, coming up and settling for a time in Harlem. How different do you think the perception of Joe Frazier would have been had he remained a New Yorker? Because, you know, you think now about the way New York City embraces its own, especially sports stars. And well, I can't imagine, as popular as Muhammad Ali might have been, I can't imagine, especially in New York, that he would have been more popular than Harlem's own Joe Frazier.
That's a good point. And to tell you the truth, Joe loves, always loved fighting in New York. He was a Madison Square Garden guy. He's in the Madison Square Garden Hall of Fame. They really embraced him there. And it's interesting, when his son turned pro, the first thing Joe did was to get together with Gil Clancy, who was then the promoter at the Garden, and sign a four-fight deal for Marvis to begin with. That was a pretty lucrative deal, you know, for a new pro.
Yeah.
And they always were very well appreciated in New York. And if you think about it, so many of his championship fights were there. Two of his three fights against Ali were in New York City at Madison Square Garden. And his fight, you know, to win his first championship was there. And several other of his main fights were in the Garden as well. And he always tended to do better in the Garden than he did elsewhere.
All right, Glenn, last couple of minutes that we have, and I really do appreciate you giving me the extended time here. 50th anniversary of the fight of the century coming up on March the 8th. What do you think people in 2021 should remember about that fight? Or if they don't remember it, what should they learn about that fight on its 50th anniversary?
I think it, just what we talked about before, I think they have to be made aware of the political and cultural ramifications of the fight and just how passionate people were about this, you know, this fight, and how distinct the sides were, and how much people had invested in the, you know, in the fight. It was an amazing happening. It was one of those things you measure your life by. You know, if you're old enough, one of the questions people will always ask you was, where were you on the night of the fight of the century? You know, and were you watching, and where were you watching from? It's almost like when, you know, they flew to the moon in 69, people of a certain age will always remember, you know, where did you view that from? And this was comparable to that. And this was worldwide. The passion for the fight did not diminish, certainly not in places like England and Italy, where, you know, fighting was really strong. The reaction to this was, you know, visceral. You could feel it. And it still is today. They still very much, you know, care about this. So I think it's important to realize what it means. The other thing is to appreciate what it took for both fighters to put together such an entertaining and such a high level fight. You know, Ali was coming back after a 3.5 year, you know, layoff. He only had two quick fights to sort of get the rust off against, you know, good fighters, but not fighters on Joe's level, which I think sort of might have worked against him. He fought good people, you know, ranked people, but he didn't realize how much he would have to turn it up to be competitive against Joe. He thought he was ready, and he really wasn't. Joe, on the other hand, had to deal with all the emotions and all the pageantry and everything that went on around this, and focus in on the fight in a way that would allow him to get the edge. After a while, Ali came out very strong. His jab really dominated the first 3 or 4 rounds and did a lot of damage and really helped him to control the beginning part of the fight. But it took an amazing effort on Joe's part, you know, in one of these early rounds to break through and start to get under Ali's defenses and to hit home to the point where the fight swung in his direction. And people forget just how good Joe was in some of the later rounds. He put Ali down in the 11th. They didn't call it a knockdown, but Ali's knees and both gloves had hit the canvas. Right. And they didn't want the fight to look like it was too one-sided, so they didn't count that as a knockdown. And then in the 15th round, he had Ali absolutely half unconscious and totally glassy-eyed. That famous picture, which is also in the book, where Ali is lying on his back and his eyes are glassy and Joe is hovering over him and sort of urging him to get back up because he really wanted to finish the job. And to Ali's credit, he managed to get to his feet and finish the fight on his feet, which nobody thought he would have.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about you, but I know that I will take a chunk of my day on Monday the 8th to go back and rewatch that fight in memory of both Joe and Muhammad. And I'm thinking as we're wrapping up here, how great it would have been if they were not only both here, but both able to have a reunion on the on the day of that fight. And what an event that might have been. If they were both able to handle that at this stage of their lives, were they, of course, still to be here. What will you do to commemorate the 50th anniversary?
Well, more radio. Actually, I'm doing a national radio show on that evening. I'm not going to do any promos for the competition, so I won't do that. I hope you revisit me and maybe we can chat a little more. But obviously it's an important night. And so for several days before and after, I'll be talking about the fight. And it's pure joy to do that.
And of course, talking about the book, last question, Glenn Lewis, what do you want people to take away from your book?
Who Joe really was as a person, how he thought about things, how he internalized things, his resilience, his generosity, his homespun humor. He was a pretty incredible guy who I really didn't give that much credit to before I met him and started to get to know him. And getting to know him has really been important. It's like, it's one of the experiences that have sort of stayed with me over the years. You know, I literally can remember certain incidents and certain things we discussed as if it was yesterday.
Well, it's an amazing project. And the fact that you were able to revisit it all 40 some odd years later and put together something so comprehensive and really so entertaining. It was really a terrific book. And you know, to bring us, as I mentioned at the outset, into the lair at the gym in Philadelphia, on the road for some of the musical gigs, and of course, through the fights, it was really a tremendous job. And I thank you, not only for the book, but for the time today.
Thank you as well. And again, really appreciate talking to you, and helps me sort of sharpen my own view of things. And your input was great.
No. I appreciate that, too. The book is called Sparring with Smokin' Joe, Joe Frazier's Epic Battles and Rivalry with Muhammad Ali. I'm Mark Renee. That is the author, Glenn Lewis, and you're On the Mark.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during O'Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, oh.